Hello and welcome to The Doctor Will Hear You Now, the podcast hosted by me, Dr. Zoe Williams. Now, I'm a practicing GP and medical professional, but in this podcast series, I'm not the expert. In The Doctor Will Hear You Now, I'm here to learn from you. Each episode, I'll face a health condition which is riddled with stigma and misinformation. By passing the microphone, literally, to a well-known name, join me as I learn their story. Plus, with the help of our wonderful series sponsor, Bupa, we'll be joined a bit later on in each episode by someone who has a lot of experience in the subject matter. Together, we'll leave each episode with a greater understanding. This is The Doctor Will Hear You Now. Now, today's topic is the only episode in this series where we're mentioning the big C. Today, we're going to be discussing bowel cancer. And bowel cancer is one of the most common cancers in the UK, actually affects 1 in 15 men and 1 in 18 women. But despite that, there's still a reluctance amongst many people to talk about their bowels or even look at their own poo. So it's really important that we have this conversation today. And one person who devastatingly was diagnosed and died from bowel cancer was the mother of today's guest. Charlene White is a staple of broadcasting here in the UK. She's a journalist, news presenter, and all-round household name. But Charlene was just 21 when her mum, Dorette, sadly passed away from bowel cancer. So I'm so grateful to you, Charlene, for coming to have a chat with me about it today.
No, thanks for having me, Zoe.
The first question I'd like to ask you is, what's the one thing you should never say to somebody whose life has been affected by bowel cancer?
Ew. Because a lot of people find the whole discussion around bowels, around poo, despite the fact that every single one of us has to have a poo at some point during the day, people do find it a bit icky. And I would say never sort of recoil when someone talks to you about the fact that they've been diagnosed with bowel cancer. Don't recoil when someone even has a conversation about it. I think for some reason, and I can't quite put my finger on it, people find it really disgusting to be talking about bowel movements when there's nothing disgusting about it at all. It's healthy. There's a reason why we do it. And the more uncomfortable we are with that conversation, the more likely we are to ignore very obvious signs when something's wrong.
You're absolutely right, aren't you? You know, what is a bodily function? They're our bodies. We own them. But I do experience that all the time. You know, I'll have patients and they'll have symptoms, bowel symptoms. And I'll say to them, you know, have you noticed any change in your poo? Is it a different colour? Has it been looser? And they'll like you say, they'll recoil and go, ew, oh, I don't look at my poo. Why not?
It's so strange. And considering the numbers, the high numbers of people that are affected by bowel cancer, it shouldn't be that situation.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there are loads of other signs as well. And unexplained weight loss being one of them, a change in appetite being another one of them. There are so many different signs that people seem to ignore or seem to not want to go and talk to a doctor about, when there's no reason for you to die from bowel cancer, because if you have an early diagnosis, you're able to live a long and fruitful life. It's when you get that late diagnosis that issues arise. And I sort of say to people, before you flush the toilet, instinctively you look in the toilet before you flush the toilet. So just look in the toilet, and if something looks different, something has changed, there's no reason why you cannot pick up that phone and talk to your doctor about it.
And the first step, as with everything, is getting to know your normal. So for people who've avoided looking at their own poo, start looking at it.
Yeah.
Get to know what it looks like, you know, and it does fluctuate from time to time. It can be a bit looser, you know, we can get a bit constipated. But if people have a sustained change that seems abnormal for them, please don't leave it. Just get it checked out.
Yeah. And I know it can be quite a scary thought to go in and see your doctor, to go in and see you and sit down and start talking about your poo. Yes, it might seem really weird and it might make you feel a bit uncomfortable, but it could save your life. So who cares if it's an uncomfortable conversation? You have to take control of your own life and be aware of your own body, because that first step is on you.
Yeah.
Your doctor doesn't know your body instinctively when you walk into a room. You know your body. So that first step is very much on you. The rest of it is where you guys come in.
Yeah.
But that first step is very much about the individual. We have to get over the fact that we might feel a little bit weird talking about it.
Because as doctors, you know, we don't feel weird. It's just a normal part of our job. We're not fazed by anything like that at all. We're very comfortable to talk about anybody's poo. So this conversation today, we're going to talk about your mum, Dorette, who sadly passed away from bowel cancer. First of all, let's hear a little bit about her. Paint a picture of your mum for us.
She was brilliant. She was very loving. She had three kids. She worked very hard. She was a strong believer in education. So we all had to do well with education. But she let us be very free to like extracurricular stuff. She came from a big family. She was an immigrant here. She went to secondary school here, which very much controlled or was the start point for her in terms of how she chose to educate us because of her experience in education here as an immigrant from Jamaica. She was very loving. She was very nurturing. And she liked looking out for people. My family always say that our house was the center of everything for both sides of our family because our doors were always open, and that had a lot to do with her.
And you grew up in Southeast London?
Yeah, in Southeast London, in Lewisham. So I say I'm a blue borough kid, very proudly so. And we were surrounded. I was in a very Jamaican household,
yeah.
Surrounded by family, surrounded by friends. Could be a very strict household because my mum grew up in the church, but also let us make our own decisions once we reached our mid-teens as to whether we continued that. But yeah, we were surrounded by, you know, getting up on a Saturday morning and going to Lewisham Market and buying our Jamaican food to cook for dinner that week and that weekend. As a parent now, I have no idea how my mum and dad juggled everything they did, because they work sort of 5-6 jobs between them in order to send us to school, whilst also being parents, whilst also making sure we're all right. My mum also studied as well, so she could get her degree in social work. You know, they were busy. They were a busy couple.
I heard you speaking about this on another podcast, and you were saying, you know, your mum would get up in the morning and she'd prepare the food and she'd sort of put it on a slow cook,
yeah.
So that then, you know, your dad would be the one who would pick you up from school. So the food was there and he could give you the food. Then he'd go back out to the work when your mum got home, and, you know, they really worked hard.
Yeah. I mean, sort of, I grew up in a household where, yes, my dad would take over the other half of cooking and he would prepare dinner for us. And then my mum would get back in from work at 5:30. And then he'd go back out to work and start at 6 in the evening, having gone to his first job at 6 o'clock that morning. And then at 6 o'clock that evening, he'd go to the second job and then he'd get home at just after 10 o'clock at night.
Wow.
And then get up the following morning, rinse and repeat. It'd be exactly
wow.
the same thing.
Juggle.
Yeah. And I remember when, because pasta wasn't a thing when we were growing up, it started later on in life. Pasta became popular here. And I say that because that's my overriding memory of my dad cooking pasta for the first time. He cooked it like rice and absolutely burnt the pot to cinders because he thought you had to boil all the water out.
Yeah.
And it was disgusting. But, you know, it was a learning process for him. So he was very much able to cook in our house. So he sort of being around dads and being around men who didn't do that, I always found quite strange, because my parents wouldn't have been able to do what they do if it wasn't 50-50.
I think we think of it as kind of a modern thing, don't we, that now both adults in the household, if there are two adults in the household, work and juggle, but actually your parents were very much living that.
Yeah, and I know, you know, it's also a very modern thing where there's a lot of angst regarding both parents working, but that was my normal, both of them going out and working whilst also parenting. That was my normal, and I don't feel like I missed out on anything.
Do you remember the point at which you first heard your mum's diagnosis?
Yeah, we were in the kitchen cooking Sunday dinner, and I can't remember if we'd been to church that day, probably, because once she was diagnosed, she then started going back to church on a much more regular basis. So we were cooking Sunday dinner, and it was like literally in the middle of probably me washing the rice or something, or soaking the peas for the rice and peas.
Because for people that don't know, a Jamaican Sunday dinner has Yorkshire puddings, but also rice and peas.
Yes, rice and peas.
And roast potatoes. Yes,
everything. And she just sort of very nonchalantly mentioned it in the general conversation that we were having that day as we were cooking. And she said that she'd been diagnosed with cancer, that she had bowel cancer, but that she was going to be fine. that she was going to start doing some treatment and it might make her tired, but essentially she was going to be fine and there was nothing to worry about. And she just needs to let me know because things were going to be slightly different with the school work routine. And I was 16 at the time. And she said, but I'm going to be fine. You know, this stuff is happening and the treatment is happening. And, you know, I've been to the doctors, they've talked me through it, but it'll be fine. And I was like, oh, right, okay. And then we just went back to cooking again. She, now that I'm a parent, I realized that she probably did that conversation over and over and over in her head to find the right way to say it to me, because I was the eldest, the right way to say it to me so I didn't panic. So I don't remember, you know, running off in floods of tears because she didn't make it sound awful. She made it sound like it was a perfectly normal thing. And we just carried on cooking and then we ate and it was fine.
So if you were just 16, how old were your brother and sister?
There's 5 years between me and my sister. So she was 11. And there's 13 years between me and my brother. So he was 3.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gosh. I think, and as you say, you know, at the time you were only a child, but now as a parent, it must have been so difficult for her to even contemplate having that
well,
conversation.
Well, I think in 3, my daughter is 3.
Yeah.
And I sort of, it's really hard for me because I can't imagine the thought of having to leave them when she's just 3. I mean, there's my daughter and I are very similar people. She's very different to my brother. My brother was very much the youngest child and a lot quieter because he had 2 older sisters who made more than enough noise in the house. So he was definitely the quieter of the 3 of us. And I can't imagine as a parent, as a mum, the thought of getting that diagnosis. And she was a late diagnosis. And knowing that there was a chance that she wouldn't see him grow up. As a parent now, I can't imagine emotionally what that can do to someone.
So how did things progress from there? Because she lived for quite a while with the illness, didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, so the average at that point was 4 years.
Right.
So she did just over almost 5 years, so in between 4 or 5 years. So she was about average at that point in time. So she was diagnosed in 1996. She was in and out doing treatments, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, different points. Her big thing, obviously, was really, really worried about losing her hair, which is the same for everybody that has that gets a diagnosis. I always think it's slightly more pronounced within Black women because you were taught throughout your entire life that your hair is your beauty. So, you know, you're under a lot of pressure to keep your hair looking nice and shiny and healthy. We are defined by our hair as Black women. So she was really scared about that. So she always considered herself one of the lucky ones because she didn't lose her hair through her treatment. She would do her treatment in the morning and go to work. There'd be moments where she would have her treatment where she had to be hospitalized for her treatment. I don't know how my dad did it, to be honest. We have a wonderful family who were there every step of the way, but there'd be weeks where she would be hospitalized for treatment. And my overriding memory is taking our portable telly out of their room, sticking it in the car, driving it to Greenwich Hospital and putting it on at the end of the bed on the wheelie table that you have and sticking various coat hangers in it to get signal so that she could watch Coronation Street and EastEnders. And we would lie on the bed and do our homework.
Right.
So she'd help us with our homework. And that was normal for us.
Yeah.
So, you know, but normal families didn't have to do that. They'd be at home and doing that stuff. But my normal was sort of lying on a hospital bed in the middle of my mum's treatment.
There's something about children, isn't there, that children are very, very resilient and I think able to, even though a very abnormal situation, scenario like that for most families, see that as their normal and almost have some kind of, I don't know, still have joy and happiness and love and all those precious moments. You still absorb that. But you had to take on a lot of responsibilities then, did you, as the eldest?
Yeah. And I also see that as sort of being normal. I don't think I really got my head around those responsibilities probably into my mid-20s. Mm. And I'd look back and just sort of think it really wasn't very fair. But at the time, I didn't really realise that. So I was doing a lot of parents' evenings with my dad. What I realised in my 20s is my mum, essentially from 16, when she got that diagnosis, it was a very conscious decision for them to start giving me more responsibility. because they didn't know how long she was going to be around for. So there was always a schedule. So they would know when I'd be at work. I made the decision not to go away for uni. I stayed at home because my responsibilities were at home.
Yeah.
So I could still do the school drop-offs and stuff. I could still do the parents' evenings. My school allowed me to not make morning assembly. No bad thing. So I didn't have to do morning assembly in sixth form because I'd be dropping my brother to school first and to nursery first at his school. And then I would go into school myself. And then my dad would do the pickups. I would come home from school. I would help with homework and such. And I would help with bedtime. So I was doing that from 16, like many families do across the country. And I was the enforcer. So if my brother was naughty, my dad would always be like, don't make me call your sister. And I'd be the one doing the telling off.
Right.
And I was the one that was very tough with them.
And did they took that from you, did they? Even though you were their sister?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Took your discipline. Yeah.
I can still do a very, very, very good telling off of my brother and sister, even in at wow. this older age.
Yeah.
I can still very much do that because although they are my siblings, I've always had, from my mid-teens, a very different relationship with them as a result. And the reason why my mum did that is because she still wanted them to have a mother figure in their life if at some point she wasn't going to be here. And I think they did that well, and it seemed seamless to me. It seemed really normal for me to take on more responsibility. It was only sort of in my mid-20s that I'd look back and think, you know, everyone else didn't have to put their work schedule up on the wall. Everyone else wasn't doing, making sure that the shopping was done. Every Thursday night was shopping night. I'd go to Sainsbury's and do the weekly shop. No one else had to do that. But that's the responsibility that I had. But they did make it very seamless for me, which I'm really thankful for.
At what point did you realise that you were going to lose your mum? Can you remember?
So they sort of sent her home for the final time, at 21. So it was the April and I turned 22 that June. And I think it was about 4 weeks before she died that they had said to her that there was no more that they could do for her. And anybody who's done cancer treatment or watched someone have cancer treatment, they know there's a change in the skin. So anytime she had treatment, her tongue would get black spots on her tongue and her skin, she'd have darker patches on her skin. So I can tell now and family pictures, the pictures where she was having treatment, the pictures where she was in remission, I can tell because of her skin. And her skin had been dark for a while and it hadn't gotten better. Mm. And she didn't have as much energy. And then she came home and she sort of said, you know, there isn't a lot more that they can do. So, you know, I'm just going to stay home now. And I realise now as an adult, that decision was made because she didn't want us to have to go to a hospice. And she wanted to make the process as normal as you can make that process. Yeah. So she came home to die, essentially. And it's going to sound really weird, but it was a really beautiful moment in time because anybody that has a Caribbean family will know that it's kind of like people just descend. So for 4 weeks, our house was packed full of people, their various aunties. There was a constant flow of food in the house. None of us ever had to cook because there was like constantly food in the house. My mum had clearly had a conversation with my aunt in Jamaica, my auntie Annette, to say that the moment at which there is nothing more they can do, she was to fly over and essentially be in the house with us. So she'd help with that transition. So she arrived from Jamaica and lived with us for quite a few months and was there to help. My uncle set up a Domino's room in our garage with a Calagas heater, a little table to play dominoes on. There was a constant flow of white rum and Appleton in there. And you constantly hear they had music in there and stuff. And in the house, there was a constant flow of church brothers and sisters that were coming to pray with my mum. The house was packed. My friends were there constantly, day and night. My friends were there and they wouldn't leave till late at night until I was going to bed. There was always someone there in the house. We were never there by ourselves, which also helped that transition.
Yeah.
Because it made it a really beautiful time as well.
Yeah. So you can look back actually, and whilst it was the most devastating thing was happening, you were actually having a really, I guess, and it was a really enriched part of your life because, well, Jamaica came to Lillerton.
It really was. And, you know, my brother obviously was still really young. Mm. So his best friend, Charlie, his parents have been amazing with him. And they'd taken him away quite a lot over school holidays. And during that period, they would, you know, rock up to take him to school, would drop him back, sometimes take him to their house to have dinner and then take him back, drop him off to rugby training, all of that stuff. It was like, we had an army.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I was going to say it's like a village, but it was more like an army.
It was an army of people and of friends and family and acquaintances and work colleagues that they had built up over years who showed up.
Yeah.
They all showed up. And we were really lucky to have
given me goosebumps that. Hearing about it. So then if it was, the households were really, really busy. Everybody was there to help. There was all this food. And then when your mum did sadly pass away, did they stay? Was that a quiet time? How was that?
No, well, then that's when the Caribbean kicks in again, because after death, the cultural rules are the house is full until the funeral and the days after the funeral. And the night that she passed, again, we'd had a house full and we had Macmillan nurses that were helping overnight so my dad could get some rest. So my dad would be in my brother's room. He'd set up a camp in my brother's room and the Macmillan nurse would stay overnight. The Macmillan nurses are angels. And my friend Leon, as he had done every single night, he was at the house watching telly with me. And he must have left about 11 o'clock, I think. And he only lived around the corner. So he wandered around the corner. And as I was going up the stairs, the Macmillan nurse came out of my mum's room and just went, it's time. So I then went and woke up my dad and woke up my brother and my sister, because me and my sister's room were in the loft. So I woke my sister up and then we came downstairs to say goodbye. I then called Leon because I knew he was awake and I told him it was time. And then they clearly had like a system in place. My best friend Dan had already told me, he had a conversation with his boss to say that something may well happen where he won't be able to come into work for a few days. So I didn't know, unbeknownst to me, Leon had done a call of everybody. My aunt had done a call of everybody. And before I knew it, our house was full again and my friends were there. And the doctor came and obviously the car van that they take the bodies away, that had all been organized and like the van was there. I was very much, my friends were making sure my sister was fine. I was making sure my brother was okay. And then suddenly we just like had a house full again. I remember leaving my friends downstairs in the living room. I was like, I'm just going to take Joshua up to bed. So I took Josh up to bed with me and I obviously fell asleep with him because I was sort of stroking his head and making sure he was fine. And then I woke up in the morning and realized, yeah, that did happen last night. And I came downstairs and my friends were all camped out in the living room. They'd gone into my sister's room because that's where the airing cupboard were. They'd found all the blankets and the pillows and the sheets and everything. And they'd slept the entire night in the living room, which I will forever be thankful for them. And I'm forever thankful for them for that. And everybody else, really, because our house was then full and it was a horrible, horrible situation. But then there's joy that comes from that as well. And it was really joyful because, again, everyone descends.
Yeah.
And there's food and there's music and there's the nine night. And the nine night, for those that don't know, it's the ninth night after someone dies in Jamaican families. You have a celebration of life. So it goes on all night till the sun comes up and there's music and there's food and there's prayer, but there's dancing and there's dominoes and there's everything. And our house was packed full of people on the nine night. And then you have the funeral, which is a celebration of life again a few days after that. I know it sounds really bizarre. I know I've just like burst into tears, but because I'm really thankful.
Yeah.
Because it's so different from, say, death within British culture or English culture, because Irish are very, and Northern Ireland, they do it in a very similar way. It's very much a celebration. It's not quiet. It's not mournful. It's a celebration and it's loud and it's raucous and it's beautiful. And I'm very proud that we have that in Jamaican culture because it makes that memory not a sad memory. It makes that memory a really beautiful one.
Honestly, thank you so much for sharing that with us because, you know, I'm dual heritage. My dad's Jamaican, my mum was white and I lost my mum and we didn't have that. And, you know, it's actually everything around her death was quite sad and not balanced by the other side, you know, the joy, the community, the friendship, the people showing up, the love, like the abundance of love that you felt. And I think, you know, thank you so much for sharing us and letting us feel a little bit of what you felt. What I wanted to ask you about is, do you think that in recent years, the conversation and the, I guess, the tone of conversation around bowel cancer and bowels in general is changing? I mean, we've had some very brave, wonderful, high profile people, Adele Roberts and obviously Dame Deborah, who sadly died last year, who have campaigned and done so much to get us normalising conversations about bowels and poo. How much do you feel that that it's changed in recent years?
I think there has been a shift, and Debs was brilliant with that. And I know that more people have gone to be tested as a result of her campaign, which is brilliant. And I don't want that momentum to ease off at all. I feel like, yes, there are more people that are talking about it, but not necessarily enough people feeling comfortable about that conversation. It's something I've spoken about very openly since Mum died, just because, you know, you have to follow these things through. So she had noticed that there had been a change. She had gone to the doctor. They had sent her for a blood test, but life and parenting and work sort of took over as ever. And she didn't go for the blood test when she should have gone for that blood test. And then when she did finally go, by that point, it was a later diagnosis, which wasn't ideal, obviously. And I think that we've just got to get to know our bodies better. We just have to, and we have to understand that responsibility lies with us. No one else knows our body like we know our bodies. And I still think there's that disconnect with some people to understand that it is about us.
Yeah.
The next step isn't about us, but that initial step can only ever be about us. You can have a long-lasting relationship with somebody who could perhaps notice something different in you and how you look, for instance, your energy levels, for example. But knowing your body, knowing the lumps and bumps and changes within your body and your bodily functions, only you can know that.
Absolutely.
And we have to get to know our bodies better and feel comfortable with knowing our bodies better. And I still think there's that disconnect that we just have to get over.
We need to be actively looking for change rather than a change be so significant that we can't ignore Absolutely. It anymore. Or, you know, get to the point where somebody else is spotting that you're losing weight. I think if people are honest, they knew that something wasn't right before that point. And cancers are different. Bowel cancer is one of the types of cancer that not always, but often will give you a clue. So with the symptoms, change in bowel habit, blood in the stool, you know, feeling tired, feeling weak. So like breast cancer, you know, breast cancer, if we are regularly checking our breasts, we stand a reasonable chance of picking something up early. Whereas there are other types of cancer that are deep inside the body, like pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer, where actually it is really difficult and often they're not picked up until they're very late. So with something like bowel cancer, if it gives you a clue, please act on that clue, you know, please do something and be looking for it, be a detective with your own body. Now, your mum was very, very young. And I know you're approaching the age now that she was when she was diagnosed, and you have a 3-year-old daughter, like she had a 3-year-old son. How does that feel for you?
Feels weird. You know, one of my best friends is currently having treatment for cancer at the moment. We're the same age and our kids are of a very similar age. And I see him and it absolutely breaks my heart, because I have more of an understanding now than I did before of how that feels when you think you won't get to see your kids, I know, walk down the aisle, have children. You won't see them as adults. You know, my mum never saw my brother and sister as an adult. I'm the only one that she saw, was able to see through to finishing studying, getting her first job. I'm the only one that she got to see happen. She had no idea what my sister was going to become, who my brother was going to become. She never saw any of that stuff. And I understand now how hard that is. You know, you put the work into these little people and you don't get to see it through. And you know how heartbreaking it's going to be for them. And you just have to hope that you've given them enough tools to be able to cope with life, and the knowledge that if you haven't, there's absolutely nothing you can do. And as I approach that age of her being diagnosed, I understand better how utterly devastating that must have been for her.
Are you, because there's a family history, do you have surveillance? Do you have any tests?
Yeah, I have been tested before because I was very worried about my bowel movements. This was pre-kids. I was very worried about my bowel movements and I did go and get tested. I had the probe up and everything.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have to be armed with knowledge. Yeah. Said you see something change, you go and get it sorted out. In my situation, there wasn't anything wrong. I was very fearful of testing in my 20s. So I very naughtily kept putting off having my smear test.
Yeah.
Because at that point, I just sort of thought, I'm not ready to have anything else go wrong. And I just thought, if I pretend that nothing can ever go wrong, then I'll be fine for a few years. Because I just wasn't ready to have to deal with any health issues with myself in my 20s. I just wasn't. I was tired of visiting hospitals. Mm-hmm. I was tired of lying in hospital beds while someone was having treatment. I was tired of my family having to deal with loss, of having to deal with illness. I was tired of everybody having to rearrange their lives because someone was ill. So I just thought, if I just put off having my smear test, then if anything is wrong, I'll deal with that later on down the line.
And how do you feel about that now?
Oh, I regularly go for smear tests now.
Yeah.
So then I started having my smear tests in my late 20s, which obviously I should have been doing it earlier than that, because I just had to have a conversation with myself and just say this is stupid, because if something is wrong and I've been putting it off, when something happens, it really is my own fault. And then I'm leaving my brother and sister without someone again. So I had to have a conversation with myself and talk myself off a cliff and just say, I need to start getting my regular tests done, and I'm fine with it now. I just had a moment where I just can't deal with anything else going wrong, so I decided to stick my head in the sand.
I think that's common though. That is really common. One of the number one reasons why people don't attend screening, and I guess cervical screening is the one that I am most familiar with, because we start screening women when they're young. One of the commonest reasons is because I don't want, if something's wrong, it's the fear of finding out, this complex, the fear of finding out. What would you say now you're through that? And obviously the reasons you had the fear of finding out were way bigger than most people. But what would you say to somebody listening to this podcast who is putting off going for their smear test, or who has got some symptoms, but they're putting off because they're so afraid of finding out something bad?
I'd actually say two things. The first would be, you've got to get over yourself. And the second would be, it's not just about you.
Yeah.
Because cancer isn't just about the person that's going through the treatment, who is hit physically with that. It's not just about the individual. It's also everybody else that's around them. Because the diagnosis and the repercussions of that never just affects one person. It affects a whole load of people, some who are blood related, some who aren't. So it's the understanding, it's not just about you. Everybody around you is impacted by that diagnosis. And all those people around you would rather have you around than have to bury you.
That's really good advice. I'm going to pass that one on to my dad, because bowel cancer affects my family, too. So my dad lost both his mum and his sister, and my dad will not get tested.
And that's very much a conscious decision.
And his daughter is a GP, and we've had lots of conversations about it. But I think it's that, it's a combination of what I call the Superman complex, which I think probably is quite common amongst men, that he feels he's fine, he's healthy, you know, he feels very confident there's nothing wrong, so therefore no need to be tested, combined with actually the fear of, if there is something wrong, finding out. And I think the advice I often give to people around that is, well, if there is something wrong, you're going to find out at some point. So you might as well have that fear and worry about it then and not worry about it now. Just get the test done. Chances are it'll be normal and you'll be fine, and then you can stop worrying about it altogether. But, you know, the importance of finding out early versus finding out late can be the difference between life and death, but also the difference between the types of treatments that you need to have. And very early, as you mentioned right at the start, if bowel cancer is found very, very early, it can actually be treated with a very small operation. And has very, very good outcomes.
But then how does it feel for you that you're not able to push him to do that? Because you know better than anyone what the ramifications of that is.
It's frustrating. And I know with my dad that, you know, at the end of the day, it's his decision, as it always is with healthcare. And I bring it up and we chat about it every now and again. And his older brother has done the same and chatted about it every now and again. But it's almost like I don't want to push too far, because that could put him off even more. So, but I think, you know, having had this conversation with you, Charlene, I'm definitely going to make a listen to this podcast.
Tell him Charlene says he's got to do it.
Tell him, Linton, say.
Linton, go and get yourself tested.
Yeah, that's perfect time to bring in our BUPA expert and, you know, chat a little bit more about the signs and symptoms of bowel cancer and make sure that our audience are armed with the knowledge of what to do. Before we continue with this important conversation, here's a quick message from our sponsor, BUPA. This episode of The Doctor Will Hear You Now discusses bowel cancer. Although it's possible to develop bowel cancer at any age, it's relatively rare before the age of 50, as you're more likely to get it as you get older. Your risk of developing cancer is also known to be higher through other factors, such as a family history of bowel cancer or having a long-term bowel condition, such as Crohn's disease. The earlier bowel cancer is diagnosed, the better your chance of surviving it. So it's important to see your GP if you have symptoms and to consider screening tests if you're offered them. Symptoms can include bleeding from your bottom, having blood in your poo, changes in bowel habit, feeling extremely tired and weak, or pain and discomfort in your abdomen. Experiencing symptoms of cancer is worrying. However, with BUPA Health Insurance, members have access to specialist centres for bowel cancer. BUPA doesn't cover you for conditions you have before taking out the policy, but you'll have reassurance for future conditions which may arise, making it easier for you to access a diagnosis and get treatment. At a specialist centre, you can get all your initial diagnostic tests in one place in one day. Plus, if there's no evidence of bowel cancer in your tests, you'll be given the all clear the same day. Search BUPA Cancer Promise for more details. Okay, welcome back, everybody. We're joined now by Petra Simic, who's Medical Director at BUPA Health Clinics, who's going to share her expertise with us from a medical standpoint. First of all, Petra, could you let us know a little bit about your experience within the field of bowel cancer?
So my experience is more in people coming to see me and either coming with problems related to their bowels or more commonly failing to mention the problems they have with their bowels. It's true that doctors love talking about poo, and I used to do a lot of children's medicine. So I call it poo within my consultations, you know, not stools, because that's not a word that people use to describe bowel movements. Yeah, we talk about poo all the time as doctors, but it's amazing how many people feel really uncomfortable doing that. So my experience is exactly in the space that we want people to come to when they've got concerns to talk about bowel movements.
Now, you've listened to the conversation that Charlene and I have just had. Was there anything in that conversation that you sort of wanted to comment on or add to or correct or, you know, add some more medical depth to that you think people would benefit from?
So I thought there were a number of things that really stuck out to me. I think the first thing to say is your mum's experience and your experience is unusual. So getting a bowel cancer diagnosis under 50 is unusual. And I think that's important to state because some of the big advocates of this recently, such as Dame Deborah, was young. And so interestingly, what I've seen is more young people worried about their bowels, which is in theory a good thing because of early awareness, but less old people thinking that it's something that is relevant to them. And yet we know the majority of bowel cancer affects people over 50, and actually over 85 is the most common age group. And I think that for me is a really important message. Any cancer diagnosis is traumatic and distressing, but definitely within my practice, I often find that older people just put these things down to aging. So they'll come and go, oh yes, well, my bowels aren't right, but you know, I'm getting on a bit. Or they keep that very private. So one of the things I'd like us to make sure that we consider is that the older you are, the more likely you are to get any cancer generally, but particularly bowel cancer. So I think that's probably something important to discuss.
And I guess to add to that, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, is a very, very common condition. And actually, in people over the age of 50, it's quite unusual to get IBS for the first time over the age of 50, because I know I've had patients in the past come to see me and they're like, well, everyone's got IBS. I just thought it was a bit of IBS. I've been stressed and I know that that can be linked. But if you're over 50 and getting symptoms that you think you would quite like to pass off as IBS, it's less likely to be IBS if that's your age group.
100%. So, you know, young people, IBS is top of the list of a condition that may give you bowel disturbance. over 50, very uncommon. And often I see people over 50 who said, oh, I've just had an upset bowel, I've had an upset tummy, but they'll talk about it having gone on months. So another really important thing, because we talk about changes in bowel habit being a really important sign of bowel cancer. And a change in bowel habit is a difference from normal for you, which is persistent. Mm-hmm. You can have very variable bowel habits depending on what you've eaten or drunk or even your level of exercise. It can massively vary.
Your menstrual cycle as well for women.
Absolutely.
Be a lot with your menstrual cycle.
Completely. You know, women get diarrhea commonly associated when they start their period. But what we're thinking about is changes that are persistent over more than a few days, and certainly anything over 4 to 6 weeks, you really need to talk to your doctor about.
And I think that really ties into what Charlene was saying earlier. For each of us as individuals, it is our responsibility to know our normal so we can spot when something has changed. But if you do have a persistent change that has stuck around for weeks, and especially if you get that inkling, which we often do, that gut feeling that something's not right, well, then it stops being just your responsibility. It's your responsibility to let the doctor know, and then you get to share that responsibility with somebody else. And if you're worried, you know, if you feel like you've ever been dismissed or you've ever been fobbed off by a doctor, don't let it end there. Ask to see somebody else or see them again and let them know. You know, if you're really worried, if you've got the inkling, you're like, it's our job actually as GPs to try and elicit what your concerns are and what your views are as to what it might be. So you absolutely have permission and you are allowed to say, this is what I think it might be, or this is what I'm worried about it being, you know, this is the thing I'd like to be ruled out. And that's actually really helpful for us as doctors when you let us know that, isn't it?
Oh, completely. And I do think sometimes people come into a consultation, they're worried about cancer of whatever type, and they don't mention it because A, it's a bit of a test, but also if they mention it, there's something in their head that if they mention it, it might be more likely to happen. So kind of getting there,
getting them to
say, so what were you concerned about, is really important. Because, you know, I see people of all ages worried about cancer, everything from, and often it's the people least likely to get cancer that are worried about cancer, interestingly. But having that conversation is really, really helpful, and then you can go through it. I think the other thing, currently it used to be that you would have a family doctor that you would probably see fairly regularly. I think now the way in which we consume healthcare means you might come across a number of different healthcare professionals if you're unwell for a number of weeks or months.
What we're saying is it's really hard to see the same GP twice.
I mean, that's very concisely put. That's me dancing around it.
That's the truth.
Yeah. And as a result of that, you might be the only person in the room that knows this is your 7th, 8th, 10th week of symptoms. Mm. So say it. Get it out there. Tell someone how long it's been going on for. If people have already done tests, tell them, because you might have even had tests in a different environment, but let the healthcare professional know exactly how long it's been going on for. And probably even more importantly, if you have a family history.
Yeah.
So getting to know not just yourself, but your family. And if someone did die of cancer, sometimes people don't even know what cancer it is, even if it's a close family relative.
Yes.
I'm always surprised when they say, oh yeah, my granddad died of cancer. You go, what type? I don't know.
Yeah, I'd be interested to ask you about that, Charlene, actually. Within your family and, you know, this army of people, was it known that it was bowel cancer? Because I know when my grandma died of bowel cancer, it wasn't really discussed or talked about. You know,
she was quite open about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was quite open about it. I mean, I always say that we're quite a cancer family, that my nanny had lung cancer. She died from lung cancer, and my uncle had it in his foot, on his heel. He developed it. So we it's something that travels through.
Yeah.
But my mum was very open about it.
But you're right, some things are real taboo. So often gynecological cancers and bowel cancers for men, kind of testicular or penile cancers, all of these things are like not just cancer, which is a taboo on its own, but God, an embarrassing part of the body cancer, even worse. And it's important if we know there's a strong family history, and by that I mean probably more than one person that's close to you or anyone young, that we dig in a little bit more to that. Around 5 to 10% of bowel cancers have a genetic component. So it's not a lot, but anyone that thinks, oh, there seems to be a cluster more than one, or someone particularly young, have a chat with your GP. You may be eligible for earlier screening or more intense screening than the general population.
Well, Charlotte, your children are very young at the moment, but have you thought about when they're older, how you'll talk to them about
the fact that there's cancer in the family? And
it would be something that I'm very, that I'd be very open about. Yeah. I have no issue talking about cancer at all, hence why I do stuff like this.
Yes.
Because I think it's very important that people realise it's something you can be comfortable discussing, because discussing it is what saves lives.
Absolutely.
So I will have no issue about doing that whatsoever. And I'm a big supporter and believer in talking very openly to people around me generally in life. And, you know, like, I'll push my partner if anything's different with him, I'll push him to go and get tested and what have you. I'm very, very open about it. And I feel like generationally, a younger generation, as you say, is a bit more open about talking about various different types of cancer, because we are having conversations about it in a way that my parents' generation never did. My grandparents' generation never did. You know, it was stuff you were supposed to be embarrassed about for some reason or another. And I feel like as we go on generation after generation, people generally are more open about talking about lots of different things regarding their bodies.
Yeah. And I think as we dampen down that stigma, we save lives. And I think, you know, also now we have access to information. You know, when we were young, or when you were young and your parents were looking after you, they couldn't just Google it. Did you have one of the big encyclopedias, like A to Z, all the medical conditions?
Yeah. No, we had like the big A to Z encyclopedia that went all across our shelves, which, you know, they died to death, didn't they? Because of Google. Yeah. But yes, we didn't have that.
Yeah.
You couldn't Google bowel cancer to get more information about it at that point in 1996.
Yeah.
You just couldn't. So, you know, all we had were our GPs to have a conversation with about it. They were our source and fountain of knowledge.
Was there anything else, Petra, that you
know? I think the other thing that really struck me in the conversation was the most amazing conversation about death.
Yeah.
Really enlightening and uplifting. And I think we need to get better at talking about what does a good death look like, because we will all experience death. It's the one thing that's guaranteed.
Absolutely guaranteed we will experience.
And what I took away from that was just how much we can control the environment surrounding death. So the conversation around it, knowing what people want when they're going through that process and not being scared of it. And I think that was wonderful to hear your experience. Really, really joyous. And I'm sure exactly and entirely as your mum intended, which is, I think, without a doubt, the most important thing. But I think that for me was really fascinating when we think about how we deal with death now. I still think that's a massive taboo.
Yes. Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
And the people do find it strange in Jamaican culture that we do see it as a celebration. Mm. That my mum's funeral we had a DJ, we had a caterer, you know, people partied until the church hall closed at, I don't know, 10:30. Everyone decamped back to our house. I think it was still going at like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, because it is an absolute celebration. But then when you talk to people that aren't used to that, they do find that quite strange. But that's my normal, because, you know, when someone's gone, it's sad, but you also have to celebrate what a brilliant life they had when they were here.
I've no doubt that when my mum listens to this, she'll be saying, that's what I want. She's always said, by the way, if anything, like, I want a really massive party. She'll be saying, you know, that description, that was exactly it, Petra. That is precisely it. So
I have some good DJs.
Yeah, so I've been taking some notes. Not that there's anything wrong with mum. She's in great health. But
it was interesting how you sort of preempted that part of the chat by saying, now people might find this strange, but I think most people, actually, especially the way you put it and you really painted that picture, I think a lot of people hopefully will take away from this conversation that the positiveness from that and the joy from that. And, you know, we all fear death. It is the only inevitable thing, but actually, yeah, painting that picture of all the things that can be good around it, you know, that absolute warm, soft blanket that you had in the people that were around you made what was the most devastating thing of your life a joyous memory.
Yeah.
I think that's really powerful.
Yeah. No, as you sort of said, Petra, people don't really like talking about death. But I think the more openly we talk about it, the more joy we can get from it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, either way, it's going to be awful.
Yeah.
But if you can sort of take even just a tiny bit of joy from that, I think it helps you later on down the line in terms of the way that you process death.
Well, it's been a joy having both of you on the podcast. Thank you so much,
thanks,
Charlene,
for
sharing all of that. Honestly, thank you so much. And then Petra also for what you've added. My hope is that there'll be loads of people out there now. Well, firstly, loads of people listening to the podcast and loads of people, you know, reevaluating some of their decisions, some of their fears, whether that's around screening, whether it's getting that thing checked out that's been niggling. And hopefully, you know, we might have just saved some lives. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for joining me, Dr. Zoe Williams, on The Doctor Will Hear You Now. For future episodes, to make sure that you're the first to know of their release, click follow wherever you're listening right now. Also, tell us if you liked it. Leave a rating or review or share with a friend. You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Zoe Williams, and I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Insanity Group.
Thank you to our fantastic series sponsor, Bupa. Here's a quick message from them. This episode of The Doctor Will Hear You Now discusses bowel cancer. Although it's possible to develop bowel cancer at any age, it's relatively rare before the age of 50, as you're more likely to get it as you get older. Your risk of developing cancer is also known to be higher through other factors, such as a family history of bowel cancer, or having a long-term bowel condition, such as Crohn's disease. The earlier bowel cancer is diagnosed, the better your chance of surviving it. So it's important to see your GP if you have symptoms and to consider screening tests if you're offered them. Symptoms can include bleeding from your bottom, having blood in your poo, changes in bowel habit, feeling extremely tired and weak, or pain and discomfort in your abdomen. Experiencing symptoms of cancer is worrying. However, with Bupa Health Insurance, members have access to specialist centres for bowel cancer. Bupa doesn't cover you for conditions you have before taking out the policy, but you'll have reassurance for future conditions which may arise, making it easier for you to access a diagnosis and get treatment. At a specialist centre, you can get all your initial diagnostic tests in one place in one day. Plus, if there's no evidence of bowel cancer in your tests, you'll be given the all clear the same day. Search Bupa Cancer Promise for more details.